This is the Education Gadfly Show.
And you like to guide people through education policy with your red nose lit up at times, even though people sometimes make fun of you and call you names.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer of Education Policy, Daniela Fairchild.
Excellent one. Good to be here, Mike.
And welcome back. It's been a while, Daniela.
It has been a while. And I will say, the Island of Misfit Toys, do you know that, you know, the claymation?
Sure.
We have this penguin sculpture thing downstairs with one of the fins off and the beak is broken off. And so basically our downstairs seventh floor event space is the Island of Misfit Toys.
I have
figured out. So that one fits.
Yes. And you like to guide people through education policy with your red nose lit up at times, even though people sometimes make fun of you and call you names. It doesn't matter. You rally in the end.
I do. I lead the troops. That's a good one.
Such a great story of triumph and overcoming. It's really a story about bullying and you know, overcoming that in the end.
It's true. That should be mandated in all public schools. See how well that goes over.
The Rudolph. I bet most public schools probably do watch that old Rudolph show.
They probably do.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, it is a tough week for all of us in this country, around the world, I imagine. Certainly those of us that think about schools and some of us who have parents. We're going to talk about Newtown, but also some other issues this week on the Education Gadfly Show. So, Pamela, get us started with Pardon the Gadfly.
The massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, was the second deadliest school shooting in United States history after the Virginia Tech massacre. What can be said?
You know, Daniela, I'm not an overly emotional guy, and I have to say on Friday as I watched the news come in over Twitter and other news feeds, I was weeping at my desk. This one really hit me, and I know it's hit everybody around the country. Little kids, so many of them, maybe for me being a parent of children the same age, you know, all of these school shootings are awful. This one really hit home for me, especially, you know, we've all gone through the aftermath, you know, the pain and suffering, then some of the stories of heroism, which are so inspiring. And now we're getting into the phase of public debate about what can be done about all of this kind of thing. What's your take on this? Is this relevant to education reform? Is this totally a different topic? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I went back and forth after having read this question on what to say. I mean, and aside from saying exactly this is, you know, a tragedy and just rocks the, you know, bedrock of kind of what we think about what an elementary school experience should be and what our own families are like, especially in the holiday season, I kept wanting to try to draw, you know, some conclusion. And the thing is that in terms of education policy, I don't think there's a whole lot that it can tell us. People can have debates about gun control and you can have debates about other public policy issues, but I mean, and I guess we can talk about school officers, you know, armed officers in schools is a big thing now, but thousands of schools in the country are already doing that. And, you know, from what we've heard about Newtown, you know, they had policies in practice. They locked the school down so the intruders shouldn't have been able to get in. They kind of were following all the right steps. And that's what's so, you know, scary about it is, you know, without going above and beyond and having sort of an over knee-jerk reaction in policy, you know, how do you stop this kind of stuff
if
they're going through all the right steps?
In other words, is it ever possible to keep something like this from happening again? A couple of thoughts from my perspective. First of all, we are all inspired by the stories of the educators that were there in protecting their children as they saw them, their kids, and both the educators that gave their lives and some who survived and ended up saving lives by hiding kids. Second is you know, I have been, I have to admit, someone who's been a little bit skeptical of all the responses to the school shootings over the years, all these lockdown drills, and, you know, are we overdoing it? Is this typical public sector behavior? Let's cover our butt by, you know, so if anything ever happens, we can say, see, we at least did what we could. Well, I feel differently about it now. I mean, because it does look very clear that as horrific as this was, there could have been many more children killed were it not for the quick thinking of the teachers who hid other classrooms of kids in various nooks and crannies, and that they had drilled on that. They had thought about in advance, where would they hide kids? Where would they go? How would they handle this kind of scenario? And so I have newfound respect. A lot of work been done in the last 10 years. Secret Service report several years ago giving schools advice on how to handle these things, drill for them, and it seemed to have saved lives. You know, I thought one of the best things I've read so far was by Michael Gerson, a columnist for the Washington Post, saying, you know, no, we can't keep this from happening again, but that isn't a call for inaction. There's a lot of things we can do. We can make it less likely. We can make it less damaging. We can do the gun control thing. We can lock up criminally insane people, and we can have schools practice these kinds of safety drills. And that doesn't solve the problem entirely, but it makes progress. And like a public health issue, it's not a matter of wiping out this mass violence from the face of the earth. Probably will always be with us, but we can make it less common and less painful going forward. Okay, topic number two.
This has been a rocky year for teacher unions. The strike in Chicago, right to work in Michigan. What are the 2012 takeaways for unions?
So I think it has been a tough year for unions on a lot of fronts. However, I mean, at the same time, you're seeing some big wins for the unions. Tony Bennett ousted out of Indiana, Tom Luna's reforms in Idaho being rolled back. So I think, you know, it's sort of a win-loss for them. At the same time, I do see in 2013 the union sort of closing ranks. I mean, both have been hemorrhaging members, sometimes, you know, 6% decreases in membership over the last year in different states, and they're going to need, they sort of now have a rallying cry. You know, you have this great reform movement being pushed forward. You've got some serious, you know, serious reforms that have been pushed hard and fast. They've got, you know, I guess a common enemy, so to speak, now. And with decreased membership, if they don't sort of combine troops, you know, for better or worse, whether I want them to or not, you know, that's when I think 2013 is going to be a lot harder of a year for them.
Look, I would say that the 2012 is really known as being a year of teacher union resurgency in some ways. I mean, the Chicago strike, which looked like a huge PR disaster throughout much of the strike, ended quite well for the Chicago Teachers Union, with them getting a much better deal than anyone imagined, with some of their leadership now having a new national profile, giving strength to some of the anti-reform folks within unions in other parts of the country. So that was a big turning of the tide. True, they lost big in Michigan, this kind of surprise at the end of the year push against the right to work status in Michigan. And that was a big loss for them. I'd be interested to see if there's other states that go for that as well. But still, you're right. Bill, you know, Tony Bennett, the Luna laws in Idaho that they were able to defeat, getting a union friendly governor elected in Washington state. I mean, they are still the 10,000 pound gorilla in education policy. They have been weakened. They are now challenged for the first time, you know, by groups like Michelle Rees, Students First, and Stand for Children, and then Democrats for Education Reform. But those groups are still the insurgents. They are still, gaining their strength and their skills and their know-how. And it's still that the unions are the dominant player, but they are less dominant than they were before. They have lost members. So there's no doubt about that. And we'll see as 2013 unfolds, what kind of public retooling they're going to do to try to push back against this now widespread sentiment that the unions are opponents to change and to reform, and too many times stand up for the ineffective teachers. Topic number three.
What are the big breakthrough ideas in school reform in 2012?
All right, let me suggest two, and then I'll go to
you. All right, go for it.
Okay, number one, grit. Grit, yes. Thanks to Paul Tough's book, How Children Succeed, we have talked a lot about grit this year and other issues around character. This idea that, you know, as important as academic achievement is, especially for poor kids, that some of these character traits seem to really matter in terms of getting kids into college and through college and out of poverty into the middle class. And that schools might actually learn how to teach things like grit, as well as other character, perseverance, and such, better. So that's a big breakthrough idea. I think the second one is the idea of diverse charter schools. In recent years, there's been a lot of complaints that charter schools are themselves quite segregated, especially urban charter schools. In other words, mostly they serve high poverty populations, high minority populations. And there's been some incentives and structural reasons why that's the case. Well, there's now a growing crop of charter schools that are diverse by design, socioeconomically, racially, and a growing movement to allow for more of them. And I think that's an important breakthrough. A lot has been written on that this year, including in some book that I happen to have something to do with, The Diverse Schools Dilemma. but many other good pieces on that too. So those are my two big breakthrough ideas for the year. What about you, Daniela?
Oh, I like it. You were thinking outside the box here. I was, thinking more policy stuff. You know, I'm thinking, oh, well, 2012 is more of, you know, sort of this year of implementation. 2011, lots of, you know, different thoughts on teacher tenure and teacher evaluation and everything else were pushed through.
Year of school choice back in 11.
Yeah. Year, thank you, Wall Street Journal.
So 2012 was the year of implementation.
The year of implementation. I guess I'm thinking, you know, sort of in what next year will provide and what next year will bring. And I think school leadership is going to emerge, you know, and we're seeing that now, a bit more of a focus on school leaders evaluation. The CCSSO just released their a blueprint on teacher evaluation, teacher preparation, teacher kind of training, but also looking at school leaders kind of. Mm-hmm. And I think so that's sort of an emergent idea that school leaders, you know, matter and can be cultivated. It's been around, but I think that's getting more mainstream and we'll see it next year as well.
You know, that's an interesting one because I really feel like many of the reforms the last couple of years have almost tried to leader-proof our schools, right? These evaluation systems that are statewide or district-wide that really tie the hands of leaders. Now, you know, if your assumption is the principals don't know how to evaluate teachers, and so we're going to give them a pretty strict rubric to use, and we're going to train them on how to do that, I guess that's one idea. And maybe in a lot of places that makes sense. But look, my own theory of school reform is at the end of the day, you've got to empower people in the school to make key decisions, to make that school special, to respond to issues. And that means empowering school leaders. And we have not been very focused on that in the reform movement. So I hope that along with trying to identify better leaders, that we're also get serious about empowering them. And that means in some ways backing away from some of the reforms of recent years, on teacher evaluation. Now you hear people talking about teacher recertification as another edge and wedge issue. But man, again, how much of this stuff are we going to try to micromanage from the state level? And at what point are we going to trust our principals?
And I'll give a brief plug to our event that we had on Monday. J.C. Brizard, who was there with us, said about the same thing. You know, he said in his time in Rochester, his time in Chicago, the best thing to do to turn around a school, to make a school great, is to empower the school leaders. So people should check out that event online.
Excellent. Jean-Claude. He really kicks some butt. All right. That is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
So, Amber, as a former teacher, I imagine Friday was a difficult day for you, as it was for all of us.
Just awful, awful, awful. Your heart is heavy. If that doesn't get to your heart and your emotions, I don't know what does. So,
did you ever have fears about that when you were teaching about something like that?
I was in an urban school. We had a metal detector for the kids. We had 5 security guards. So I really didn't. I didn't. And it was partly because of those precautions in place, but it was partly also because we had a great principal who was very observant and diligent and who the kids trusted and the faculty trusted. And somehow she made us feel safe there, too.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, then all of those things, you know, you have an armed assailant blasting his way into a school. None of that matters. But, terrible. All right. What you got for us this week?
We have a new study out by Calder. It's called The Effects of Texas's Pre-Kindergarten Program on Academic Performance. I hate that Joe makes me say these titles now. Anyway, it examines the impact of a targeted pre-K program in the Lone Star State. They use 13 years of individual student data, pretty big deal, 10 million students enrolled in Texas public schools between 1990 and 2002. At-risk kids are eligible, but just a little wrinkle in that. It's not just poor kids and ELL kids. It's homeless kids, those in foster care, parents who are in active duty military, or kids whose parents have been injured or killed in active duty. So a little bit broader definition than typical. The sample includes kids who were continuously enrolled in Texas public schools until third grade, and they took the third grade state test. Okay, 57% of eligible kids attended the state-funded program in the time frame the analysts looked at. Bottom line, they compared students who attended the program with eligible students who didn't. They controlled for a ton of factors. They tried to deal with selection bias. They found that participating in the program is associated with increased scores on both the math and reading portions of the state test, reductions in the likelihood of being held back a grade, and reductions in the likelihood of receiving special education services, especially potent for poor kids and kids with limited English skills. Those kids experienced the greatest gains. Effect sizes were robust. I started looking at them saying, okay, how big of a deal is this? Yep. And they're a pretty big deal when the intervention occurred 4 years prior, you know, because these kids are being tested in third grade. Keep in mind, though, the one thing I was digging in is trying to figure out the control group. So the control group kids could have stayed at home. They could have participated in a private pre-K program. They could have done Head Start. We don't know. So what we need to think about is the results are really interpreted to, okay, this is what happens when you have an extra option. This is not the best of the options because we don't know what the other kids did. Ironically enough, the last thing, this program, apparently the National Institute of Child Early Education Research ranks all the pre-K programs, and this one ranked very poorly. Ranked poorly on class size, which I assume means there's lots of kids, and ranked low on spending. So I guess it's expensive.
But we're not expensive.
We're not expensive. Who knows? So the analysts end up saying, well, maybe these modest programs are, that was their word, modest, are pretty good after all.
Wow. Very interesting. So, okay, a couple of things. So they just looked at the third grade. I mean, when we've looked at Head Start in the past, there's this issue of fade out, right? Mm-hmm. You see an impact immediately, but it faded. Do you know if it fades out usually by third grade, it's already fading out?
Yeah, I don't remember that Head Start. I don't remember.
Probably about by then.
Yeah.
So this is, right. I mean, it'd be interesting to know, you know, by eighth grade or, you know, do we see fade out later on? Or
yeah.
Do these gains seem to continue?
That's still third grade. I think that's pretty good.
It's pretty good.
Right?
No, it's really good.
Because by then the kids get a solid start. You know, that's why we test reading in that grade and everything else. So.
And then, you know, the selection bias question. I mean, the question is, isn't there something, you know, there must be something different about these kids who are in these programs versus in the other programs.
Right.
And is that what's explaining it? Particularly if the kids who are the poorest kids are the most likely to be in Head Start and therefore not in this one.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I mean, I guess they control for that.
Yeah,
but
they did the best they could. And they also tried to look at not only selection bias, but whether or not if a program was located nearby, you know, like did that sort of incentivize kids to go too. So they had to look at where these programs were located.
All right. And do we know much about the program? I mean,
I kept digging in.
So this is not a Perry preschool spend $25,000 per kid.
No, but it's been around since, I mean, what, the early 90s. So it's been around for a long time. But yeah, they didn't. I was hoping for a section of the report where they'd say what the program's all, what it includes, instruction or, you know, whatever, tactile skills, whatever these kids are learning. But yeah, that wasn't, the black box was not in the study. So yeah, it made me curious though.
Yeah. No, I mean, promise. And another thing, Daniela, is that this is a program that's targeted at disadvantaged kids, right?
Exactly.
This is not universal. We're not just spreading the money around to everybody, including middle-class kids who already are going to preschool on their parents' dime, right? So this is, I mean, we're supporting, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you're right. Some of the research that we've seen before has shown the same, you know, kind of thing, that, you know, targeted preschool for poor kids really helps. And you get into sort of across the board preschool and start losing a little bit of the efficacy and having it cost a little bit more.
Well, right. It just costs a ton of money. That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you, Amber.
Yeah, Checker's going to like this study, right?
This is promising.
His book?
This is when he wrote, Derail the Preschool Juggernaut. Yes.
We all like that word, Juggernaut.
Juggernaut.
In unison.
He was really arguing against universal pre-K and for targeted programs.
Pre-K.
Yeah.
Right.
So this is, score one for Checker.
Yeah, buddy.
That's great. And hey, actually a study that shows positive effects.
Yeah.
I mean,
long term, not just, I mean, a lot of these studies are like 1 year and it drives me nuts, you know. So.
Yeah. Ending the year on a positive note.
Yes, we
Amber.
Are.
We appreciate
indeed.
That.
Yes.
Well, I hope 2013 brings us many more positive findings from the world of education research.
Me too. Here.
That is all the time we've got for this week and for this year until 2013.
I'm Daniela Fairchild.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off. Happy holidays, everyone.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.